We just finished our winter membership drive.
We did.
And it was a quite successful one.
It was.
And the listeners of this show came forward once again and demonstrated their support, not only of this program, but of the station.
You know, one day we picked up $1,800.
I know. We did. It was extraordinary.
Extraordinary.
So I just want to thank everybody who helped support KBOO during this past membership drive.
I think
really, really appreciate it.
I think it's appropriate, wise, and good.
Indeed. And if you are still interested in doing so, you don't have to wait till the next membership drive.
No.
You can do it right now.
And remember, the commitment to make a contribution is really a promise on your part, and honor requires you to do it.
Yes.
Yes.
Honor demands it.
Honor demands it.
So you can log to www.kboo.fm. Click on the tip jar and make a contribution. It's really easy, quick, quiet, stealthy, and fun.
Okay. So Ukraine.
Yes.
Okay, first thing people need to know is that Ukraine, like many nations in the world, was shaped through a variety of historical epochs.
No, that's not the first thing they need to know.
What's the first thing
where
they
is
need
it?
To know? Oh, where is it, right? It's on the western and southwestern edges of what was part of the Soviet Union.
It borders the Black Sea.
Yes, and it was one of the original four Union of Soviet Socialist Republics.
Right. One of the founding members.
Yes.
And of the band, as it were.
Yeah, as it were, such as it is. And, in fact, it has an incredibly bloody history. In fact, when we talk about this, what we're really talking about is an area that during a world war, from 1920 on, really until the 1950s, was an enormously, horribly mistreated and blood-ridden area.
Oh, indeed. And it goes back even farther. But we'll get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that. But, you know, and including a deep anti-Semitism, a tremendous anti-Polish and pro-Polish sentiment, just all kind of horrible.
Anti-Russian and pro-Russian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm going to talk about its history up through, I don't know, the point when I get bored and you take over. And we're going to want you to be patient. This is a history lesson.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here we go. First of all, the Ukraine in the 9th century. Oh, my goodness. The 9th century. It was the Rus were the people there. Now, it's interesting because the term Russian is from this term Rus. And the centers were the Rus Kiev, Kiev. And essentially, it was called the Rus by other Slavic tribes. It comes originally from the Finnish.
Yeah.
Finns were there.
Yeah, the Rus originated in Scandinavia.
Yeah.
Kind of conquered their way south.
Right, and in fact, the Vikings traveled down there and traded.
Yeah.
All the way down to the Black Sea and into the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so, St. Vladimir. Who could forget St. Vladimir?
Yeah, not me.
Boy, heck not. Brought Christianity from Byzantium in 988.
Yes, this would be Eastern or Orthodox Christianity.
Orthodox Christianity.
Yes.
Yes. It, that is the Rus, extended north and west during the 11th, 12th centuries, and this was interrupted by the Tartar invasion. Not
saucy.
The stuff in your teeth, but
they're saucy, those Tartars.
They are a saucy bunch. Actually, 1237 to 41 is the invasion, and the Tartars were the Golden Horde.
People also call them Mongols.
People also call them Mongols because ethnically they were.
Mm-hmm.
It's appropriate.
Yeah,
and this was under the leadership of the grandson of the great Khan,
mm-hmm.
who extended his power all the way at one point all the way to the Danube River.
This was Kublai Khan.
Yeah, yeah.
In Xanadu.
And Pleasure Domes.
Pleasure Dome Decree.
Yes. Anyway, those peoples who settled there are a mix of ethnic groups, ethnic tribes largely, but the Tartars were a very immensely impacting group. And that whole business of the Tartar involvement was overcome later by Polish princes who took over what is known as Galicia. Then comes Lithuania. Lithuania and Poland had a war, or several wars actually, and the lands were traded off there. Basically, it was divided between Poland and Lithuania until about 1380, then the Ukraine was a victim or a partner with the Polish expansion. The borderlands, as they were known, Ukrainia actually means borderland. Mm-hmm. And it was the Poles who brought a different Christianity, Roman Catholicism. So now you have, at this point, early on, a division between the Russian what becomes Russian Orthodox or Eastern Rite Christians, and then the Roman Church, Catholic Church, mm-hmm. the one we know today,
right,
and. This distinction, not only is this distinction of religion, but it's of culture in a tremendous way. So Ukraine experienced the Polish expansion, and the border went east across an area later called Ukraine. You had feudalism, of course, with feudal lords deciding stuff. Huge open spaces, later to become the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. And you had outlaw Turkish tribal people operating there. In the 16th century, the Polish knights and the Muscovite grand dukes created an entity which became Ukraine. And a lot of this was a move against the Tartars, these Mongols of the East. The Polish and Lithuanian peoples united in 1569. Ukraine essentially became a territory separated from Lithuania and essentially became Polish. And that's where Catholicism becomes extremely powerful.
Now, in parts of what is now Ukraine.
In parts of what's now Ukraine. And if you looked at a map, there's an excellent one in the New York Times today, you will see that that the Polish influence was very strong, and that, in fact, the parts of the Ukraine could almost be split in half based on the western and northern parts being Catholic and the eastern and southern parts, particularly around the Crimea, being...
And Black Sea,
being basically part of the old Orthodox Rite.
So I'm sensing a trend here.
Are you?
Really, it seems ever since the peak of the Kievan Rus culture in the 10th and 11th centuries, beginning with the Mongol invasion and then really proceeding through most of the following several centuries, the Ukraine has been squeezed between various powers, whether it's the Russians to the east or the Poles to the north and the west, or the Austro-Hungarians later, or the Turks from the south. Really, it's been Ukraine's been a battleground that other folks have fought over.
Yeah, and part of this fighting at various times was a slaughtering of the Poles who were in the region, who had settled there, because it was an empty, relatively speaking, space, mm-hmm. and the Jews. Hmm. So Jew killing, pogroms, mm-hmm. was a historic ritualized behavior in this region. Now, this is extremely important, not just because people are getting killed, but because it is part of a pattern of anti-Semitism that eventually makes its way throughout the entire Russian area. And there's a book called Bloodland, which talks about the period from 1920 to nowadays and about the enormous slaughters of people. And it's just incredible and horrible. And typical, unfortunately, of history itself. And I'm going to jump ahead. In 1876...
Well, I think you skipped over something important.
What is that?
There was a period in the 1600s, about a 30-year span, that Ukrainians now look back on and call the Ruin.
That's right.
It was basically a 30-year war between Russia, Poland, Turkey, and the Cossacks for the control of Ukraine.
Right.
Devastating to the indigenous population. Ruinous economically, agriculturally. It was really, really a bad time.
Starving times.
And there are a number of starving times in Ukraine's history. And
right.
We'll get to more of that.
Right. Well, okay. And in addition to this, that you mentioned the Cossacks.
I did.
Well, the Cossacks, everybody in my family... There was a tradition of hating the Cossacks.
Oh, yeah?
Because they were the shock troops that went after the shtetls, the small Jewish communities throughout that region and throughout Russia.
And do you still have that tradition, hating the Cossacks?
Me, personally?
No, your family.
My family is long gone.
Do you get together?
I'm the last one.
Oh, yeah? So you don't get together every year and hate
and
the Cossacks?
And hate the Cossacks.
No?
Yeah, the famous ritual hating of the Cossacks. No, but I do remember my grandmother using Yiddish to describe bad authority as Cossacks. And the Cossacks were used to break the power of the left historically. Once they became part of the Russian Empire, the Cossacks were the shock troops. If you've seen the movie Battleship Potemkin, and Eisenstein, great movie. That's the one with the famous steps of Odessa. Odessa is part of Ukraine,
yes,
and at the Crimean, and the famous scene, and the lady's glasses are smashed, and the baby carriage rolls down the steps as these guys holding bayonets march down the steps. Those are the guys marching down the steps are the Cossacks, and the Cossacks were used as the shock troops of the Tsar. And they became a privileged or quasi-privileged group. And they were very significant in this history, off and on. But you really begin to see a nationalism as a Ukrainian notion developing in the 1700s. And I'm going to jump ahead because there's so much that goes on. By 1917, by the time of the Russian Revolution, by the time of World War I, there's a nationalist movement that's very strong in Ukraine. Now, remember, Ukraine was not much under its own power during all the time previous to that.
Right.
Now there's a rising nationalism. And in late 1918, the USSR creates the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic as part of the original four republics of the Soviet Union.
What were the other ones?
Let
me guess here. Belarus?
Yeah.
Lithuania?
Belarus, Ukraine. Why did you do that?
Russia.
I wasn't ready with that.
I was just wondering. I was curious.
Okay, no, there's another one. I'll find it here.
Oh, well.
You've embarrassed me. Now you'll die. Okay. the Reds captured Kiev on the 10th of February in 1918. Now, you got to see this in the context of World War I. The Russians, after the kicking out of the Whites and the creation of the Soviet state under Lenin, essentially withdraw from the war. They give up an enormous amount of territory to end up with peace because the slogan of the Soviets was bread and peace. And they had to fulfill that. Now, the bread part is the Ukraine.
Yes.
And peace is when you give up a bunch of land to the Central Powers. That's the Ottoman Empire, always a player in all of this, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and Germany. So suddenly you find the Ukraine basically at peace, but, and I think I better jump ahead. Lenin writes a letter on December 28, 1919, giving equality to the Ukrainian people, and the Poles withdraw from the region. The Poles are involved in trying to establish it as part of an extended Polish empire, which they do not win and they do not get. And there's something called the Riga Treaty with Poland and Russia, creating the communist Ukraine, essentially.
I found the answer to that question, by the way.
Oh, what is the fourth one?
The four founding Soviet republics.
Go for it.
Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Transcaucasus.
That's what I couldn't remember, the Transcaucasus.
Okay.
Who could forget the Transcaucasus?
We did, apparently.
I did. Yeah. I don't know if you did.
I didn't even know.
I definitely did. Okay. So now you have the Soviet system. Meanwhile, there is a strong nationalist movement in Ukraine which practices and preaches everything in the Ukrainian language, which is similar to Russian, but
very
not the
similar.
Same. Very similar. Yeah. One usually can read the other.
Yeah.
But not the same.
Right.
And that's a significant force. Now, remember, we've got Ukraine, a new nation acknowledged as part of the Soviet Union, but not really free. It's under the Soviet suzerainty. And it is the breadbasket of the entire region. Meanwhile, starving times come.
Yes, lots of them.
Lots and lots of starving times. And Stalin takes power.
Yes.
1920. 22 actually, Stalin takes power, and he abandoned something that was liberal that had been created by Lenin as a matter of practicality, called the New Economic Policy. The New Economic Policy allowed individual farmers, wealthy ones called kulaks, and poorer ones to own land in Ukraine and elsewhere. It allowed a limited degree of capitalism. It allowed a great deal of freedom of speech. It created the constructivist art movement, which is a very exciting art movement. In fact, there's a show of constructive art right now going on at the Modern Museum in New York City. And it's pretty neat stuff. Though then Joe Stalin decides that the bread isn't happening. People are still starving in Russia. People are not having a good time in Ukraine. But he decides to make it even better by collectivizing, as a matter of communist philosophy, all of the lands of the Ukraine. And what that does is lands that had previously been given or allowed, lands particularly in the hands of wealthier farmers called kulaks, all are stripped from the people. And any resistance is met by death or by transportation to the gulags. Meanwhile, the grain is not being farmed very efficiently. People are resistant. But also, all the grain that's available goes to Russia from the Ukraine. If you hoarded seed, you know, grain seed, wheat seeds, if you had grain in your storehouse, it was assumed you were violating the rules, and you would be killed. In the course of the famine that followed all of this, 5 to 6 million people starved to death.
Yes.
And you know, we talk about this stuff, and this is before World War II, by the way. We talk about this stuff, but I don't think most of us, maybe because of our our heritages, our national heritages or something, can understand it to some degree, but we have never experienced starving times.
Oh, good Lord, no.
I mean, this is, in
addition to the famine you just mentioned, there was one in the early 1920s that claimed about 6 million people.
Right.
And again, in 1932-33, it's estimated up to 10 million Ukrainians died.
Yeah, this was by the policies of Stalin.
So you're talking about a 10-year span of time.
Okay,
upwards of 15, 16 million people died.
We should talk about World War II.
We should.
You want to do it? I'll do it.
Why don't we both do it?
Oh, we'll
all right,
both.
You begin.
Okay. So the Soviets, under the leadership of Stalin, first make a pact
with the Nazis. Fascist Germany.
With fascist Germany. This follows the period when, in fact, they were fighting fascism in Spain.
Yeah.
So the inconsistencies of the Communist Party become evident at this point in history. International Communist Party, known as the Comintern, and all of that forms a kind of a background to the whole history of the left in modern times, even in this country. Meanwhile, Stalin's squeezing everything they can out of the Ukraine, putting everything into collective farms, with the idea that a collective farm is more efficient. But of course, if you take land away from a farmer and you turn it into collectivized land, his or her motivation for producing large bumper crops is fairly limited.
Yes, yes,
there
it
are
is.
Consequences to such things. So Stalin makes a deal with Hitler. Basically, they cut up Poland between them.
Yes,
which is moving down toward Ukraine, and then Stalin refuses to recognize the fact that Hitler's decided to go ahead and attack Russia to get the breadbasket, as it were, and to colonize all the so-called Slavic areas and to kill all those people or limit them in large numbers and to place farmers of German extraction in that region. It's a massive, massive movement.
Part of Hitler's overarching plan to enslave the Eastern people, the peoples of Eastern Europe.
Yeah, and... Yeah. Also part of that is Hitler's notion, which he has in mind with the Japanese at this time, to create a vast worldwide pincer movement that will essentially yield him the huge oil fields of the Crimean region.
Right.
And the Black Sea.
Right.
So that's his thrust. And resistance develops out of Ukrainian nationalism, but it isn't just resistance to the Nazis. It's resistance to Russia, the Soviet Union, its resistance to anything except Ukrainian nationalism. And in the course of that, Jews become fair game to be slaughtered. Russians become fair game to be slaughtered. Germans become fair game to be slaughtered. And in the middle of this, various factions or partisan groups develop. Huge numbers of people side with the Nazis against the Soviets. And this is it becomes a killing ground of vast proportion.
Seriously vast proportions.
I mean, yep. A thing we can't even imagine.
Ukraine's historical capital during this time, Kiev, which was renamed Stalingrad.
Ah, yes.
Was the site, of course, of the siege of Stalingrad, which really marked the height of fascist German power during...
Now, is Kiev Stalingrad? I don't think so.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
If I'm wrong, call me up and tell me.
You're wrong.
I'm wrong. Okay.
Okay.
But in any event, I had a history professor once.
Volgograd was Stalingrad.
Was Stalingrad.
Not
okay.
Kiev.
All right then. But also in the region.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a history professor once describe the siege in Stalingrad as the worst place to be at any point in all of human history.
Pretty close.
Yeah.
There were a lot of bad things in human history. But I'll go with that. I mean, it was horrible. People were dying of starvation in the streets. They'd fall and lie. Where they lie was where they were.
Right.
Because
right.
There was no place to bury anybody. There was there was no strength to carry bodies.
You described the pact between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. Hitler broke that pact.
Yes.
Started pushing east. The great Operation Barbarossa,
right.
Which famously bogged down in the Russian winter.
In the Ukraine.
In the Ukraine, installed out in the siege of Stalingrad that I just described.
Yes.
And
which
really,
is not Kiev.
Okay.
It's anyway.
Just, and that was really the Germans really never advanced
never
any farther than that. And
no,
that was the beginning of the end.
They got to a siege of Moscow, a siege of Leningrad, a siege of Stalingrad, Volgograd.
Yeah.
Now, once again, Volgograd.
Right,
and that's where the Russians stopped the ambition. Really, one of the things people don't understand in this country, and it's really important. World War II was not won by the United States.
No,
World War II was won by the Soviet Union.
The Soviet Union. Total deaths during the Second World War. This is deaths of people, active combatants, civilian deaths due to combat, and civilian deaths due to war-related famine and disease are estimated at about 18 to 24 million people. That was about 14% of the country's population at the time.
Yes, and
staggering.
Right, and something else to understand: at the end of the war, parts of Poland were gobbled up by the Soviet Union and added to Ukraine. And Stalin gave to the Ukraine, give is a kind of weird term, but increased its holdings of land to the south, to all of the Crimean region. So essentially the new republic that we understand today as Ukraine was increased by areas that had previously been under the rule of the Ottoman Turks, areas that had previously been under the rule of the Polish, and under the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So all of this land now becomes Ukraine with a strong, strong strain of Ukrainian nationalism and a division between the Polish-oriented but largely nationalist Ukrainians to the north and east, right?
Mm-hmm.
And who are more or less part of the Roman Catholic faith. And to the south and, well, no, to the south and east, the north and west, I should have said, to the south and east, the country is essentially under the influence of the traditions of the Orthodox Church. But remember, there's no church at all because this is the Soviet Union,
right.
So the repression of religion in general also affects this. So you develop a kind of nationalist underground movement. And during the war, during World War II, there were armies who would slaughter the Germans sometimes, or another army would slaughter the Russians sometimes, or they'd slaughter, or everybody slaughtered the Jews.
I sense a common theme.
Yeah.
Slaughter.
Slaughter.
Yes.
Yes. And this, like I said, there's a book called Bloodland. It's just, you can't believe the cruelty and the horror that this war involved in the Ukraine.
So let's jump ahead.
Let's jump ahead.
To the end of the Soviet era.
Okay.
1989, the early 90s.
Well, right. I don't know if we can jump quite so far ahead.
Okay.
because we have a little event that really does also shape this thing called
called the Chernobyl disaster.
In
1986, there is a nuclear power plant located at Chernobyl in Ukraine,
which is just north of Kiev, which is on the border with the old Soviet other republic,
which famously melts down in what is still history's largest.
I checked this out.
Fukushima is not as big.
Fukushima is almost as good.
Yeah, but it's not as bad. It wasn't as bad. Yeah. There's a rating.
That's because there was no containment vessel at Chernobyl.
At Chernobyl, no.
So when the thing blew, it went all over the place.
Oh, it was really bad. There is an area that is still unoccupied. Within several mile radius of Chernobyl. You just go there. Nobody lives there. There is a new city that has been built just outside this exclusion zone to house and service the people who are still working to contain and clean up this disaster.
Right.
There's an international scale for nuclear disasters. Chernobyl, until the Fukushima disaster, Chernobyl was the only disaster to ever have achieved the highest rating of 7. I don't know how that scale is formulated.
The scale of 1 to 7?
Or how it's measured. Chernobyl was a 7, and there hadn't ever been a 7 before or since until the Fukushima disaster in 2011.
Right.
So that was a problem.
Yeah, that was a problem. So we've got famines, we've got civil war, we've got unrest, we've got pogroms, we've got World War II and the vast struggle of it.
Yes. So the Soviet Union breaks up in 1989-1990. In July of 1990, the Ukraine declares its independence and its sovereignty, and the modern nation of Ukraine that we know today is established.
Well, the sort of modern.
Sort of modern nation. Yeah, with its current borders.
And with its current borders, and with a ruling class, a nomenklatura, a class of individuals who are totally corrupt, running the country.
Yes. Now, we should...
Just like Russia, I might add.
We should note that the eastern and southern parts of Ukraine are, some of them, predominantly Russian-speaking. There's a large ethnic Russian population, and there has been a segment predominantly in the southern and eastern regions of Ukraine that have resisted Ukrainian nationalism since 1990 and have lobbied and agitated for closer ties with Russia.
Right. And at the same time, with the establishment of the European Union, there has been this opportunity. The U.S., when the Soviet Union collapsed, the U.S. took the opportunity to surround the what remained of the old Soviet Empire with missile bases and troop stationing and so on from all of the Western powers and the United States.
Yes, this is true.
And in other words, there was a ring of fire, if you will, around the former Soviet Union, the parts that were still part of Russia.
Right.
And Ukraine was in the middle of that, essentially loyal to and sticking with the Soviet Union, well, with Russia, but under the incredible horror of the situation in the region, always starving times, now still starving times, with a ruling class that were incredibly corrupt, just like in Russia at this point, the Ukrainians are get an offer from the European powers. Essentially, the European powers say, hey, we'll give you a boku buck. We'll have trade with you. We'll provide you with everything you need. And all we're asking from you in exchange, and this is in the fine print, is we get to station our missiles here.
Right.
And the Russians go, not on our watch.
Well, there's something else rather significant that happened
too.
And say what you will about the Bill Clinton administration in the United States. Say what you will.
Okay.
I think one of that administration's enduring accomplishments was the rounding up of loose nuclear materials and the decommissioning of nuclear arsenals in the former Soviet Union.
Right.
Ukraine was part of this. In 1996, they shipped off the last of their nearly 2,000 strategic warheads for dismantling. And the official line now is that Ukraine is no longer a nuclear state. Who knows, though? Maybe there's one still lying around. I don't know. Anyway, but that was a rather significant development.
Right. Meanwhile, here's the Ukraine, now under Putin's, now influenced by Putin's Russia. Putin, he's the head of Russia now.
Yep.
He likes to parade around with his chest bared.
Yeah, riding a horse.
Riding a horse. Yeah. And he plays
with bears.
And plays with tigers.
Yeah.
Very macho.
He's a man's
very,
man.
Man's man, yeah. Yes. And he looks at this situation with the European Union and says, oh, man, I don't want any, you know, this happened in Poland. I don't want this happening to us. And he offers, in the middle of this, you got to understand, this is a continuing crisis of poverty in the Ukraine. And he offers cheap money and virtually cheap, free, almost, natural gas to the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Which brings us kind of up to where we are.
No, we're missing something.
What are we missing? What are we missing?
2004, this wonderful, beautiful thing happened. I'm sure you people will remember.
Oh, the Orange Revolution.
The Orange Revolution. There was a...
Who could forget the Orange
Revolution? Presidential elections in 2004, which ushered in a power guy named Viktor Yanukovych. Now, we're going to come back to Yanukovych because he's still a player in Ukrainian politics. It was a corrupt election, completely rigged, and the populace didn't buy it for a second.
Right.
So what you just referred to as the Orange Revolution took place. Millions of Ukrainians camping out in Kiev in sub-zero temperatures, agitating for free and clear elections. It was a wonderful thing. Inspiring.
It was a grand moment. A grand moment.
Inspiring for people the world over. Some bizarre stuff happening at this point. A guy by the name of Viktor Tymoshenko, Yanukovych's chief rival, was poisoned. You remember that?
Oh, who could forget that?
Oh, it was crazy. And so
dioxin.
Yeah.
Dioxin poisoning.
Yeah, it was crazy.
And he was all scarred up. And
yes. Massive demonstrations in Kiev and around the country. Yanukovych is ousted. A new government takes over, and it's looking like perhaps the dawn of a new age for the Ukrainian Republic.
Right.
It didn't work out quite so well.
Oh, what happened?
Well, it's still this corrupt ruling class that you talked about.
Right.
Really maintained its grip on electoral politics and upon the economy and everything. There was, after this brief period of optimism fizzled out, there were some other disputed elections, and Yanukovych found himself again back in power.
Ah.
Which more or less brings us up to today.
Okay, then a nationalist movement, a very strong nationalist movement, particularly in the areas where people speak Ukrainian as opposed to Russian, develops.
Mm-hmm.
And a huge siege develops in Kiev. And that really does bring us right up to now. The siege becomes very intense, and the existing government decides to use snipers and armed police and shoot into the crowds. And kill people, 50 people killed, we know of.
Well, there's some other stuff we should talk about, too.
Okay, go ahead.
And I see we've got some calls, and we're going to get to them in just a second here.
We will.
There was late last year, there was an offer on the table before President Yushchenko.
Yeah.
Yanukovych. What am I talking about? Yanukovych.
Oh, Yanukovych.
Okay. From the European Union, offering closer economic ties, the possibility of eventual EU membership is dangled before Ukraine, and most of the citizens, particularly those in the Ukrainian-speaking north and west parts of the country, are wanting this. Closer ties with the European Union, a separation from Russia. Russia, of course, objects, wants to keep the Ukraine close, and Yanukovych is a Russian sympathizer. Close ties with Putin, wants to maintain closer relations with Russia. He rejects the European Union's offer and throws his lot in with Russia.
And you got to, overarching of all this is the incredible corruption of the ruling classes of both Russia and Ukraine, who live in a kind of wonderland of late 19th century over-decorated gaudy homes and castles and swimming pools and hunting lodges and private zoos and all kind of stuff, while the people are barely able to eat.
So over the past several weeks, as you described, there are increasingly violent clashes amongst Ukrainian nationalists and supporters of the presidential administration. Things reach a head in about the last week, and then just a couple days ago, Yanukovych is ousted from power. The Ukrainian parliament votes to impeach him. He flees the capital. His current whereabouts are as yet unknown, and new elections have been scheduled for May, and it looks like the Ukraine is poised to throw its lot in with Europe and distance itself from Russia, and maybe this time around things will
maybe
be better.
Maybe. We want to hear from you on this, but first we have to do these announcements.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, an alternative radio reporter and author Sonia Nazario speaks on the courage of immigrants. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, anti-war resistor Colonel Ann Wright reports back on the geopolitical struggle against U.S. power in the Koreas. And host Dennis Bernstein speaks with Dr. Victor Rios, author of Punished, Policing the Lives of Black and Latino Boys. At 11 on Station Studio, host Emay Roberts features the 7th Annual Portland, Oregon Women's Film Festival at the Hollywood Theater. We'll also hear a feature piece on defunct theater's production of Let 100 Flowers Bloom. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake speaks with Ryan Reuter and Ria Reuter Sleeman about the work of their father.
Is that the Reuter, Roto Reuter people?
No. The late American painter Leonard Reuter. But thank you for that question.
I thought it would be useful.
All this and more coming up today on KBOO.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones.
Now, let's go to the phones. We're talking about Ukraine. We want to hear from you on Ukraine.
Who's next? Joanne, good morning.
Hello?
Hi, Joanne.
Hello, I sure like to sing Pete Seeger's song, When Will They Ever Learn, But It Won't Do Any Good. But anyway, I sure needed all that history because I never got much of it in my life. And I just want to ask one thing. Is there any connection between the energy of the Olympics being held in Russia and all this history? And thanks for the program.
Yeah, thank you. The answer is yes. There is a connection. Mm-hmm. This was the moment for Russia to show its post-Soviet strength and glory and beauty and fancy-ansiness. And what it ended up really showing is the totalitarian nature of the modern Russian state.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, there are 40,000 Russian troops stationed just outside Sochi during the extent of the games.
And, of course, you all of you out there should know that there is, within the old Soviet republics, a vast movement by Islamic fundamentalists to break off those states.
So, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Now, as things stand right now, as I mentioned, there are elections scheduled to be held in May. We don't know where Yanukovych is. We have former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. She is the widow of the Tymoshenko who opposed Yanukovych back in the 2004
Orange Revolution. And she had beautiful hair at one time.
Right. But she has spent much of the intervening time in prison after her stint as Prime Minister.
And her health is bad. She's in a wheelchair.
Her health
now.
Is bad, yes. She was released from prison. She went straight to Independence Square in Kiev and addressed the throng waiting there, and now is considered a front runner to reassume the prime ministership after the May election.
Unless she gets poisoned.
Unless she gets poisoned, like her former husband got poisoned. So this is very dramatic, very exciting stuff.
And interestingly enough, the Obama administration is being cautious, unlike the Bush administration in past activities. There's a greater level of caution.
Indeed. So why is this important, Joe? What does this mean?
Well, what do you mean, what does it mean?
What does it mean? Why should we care?
Well,
what's happening in the Ukraine?
This is part of a vast change in the world. There are independence movements and democracy movements. We need to distinguish between the two because there are differences. And, essentially, this is a moment in history where great change, positive change in terms of our belief in democracy and free speech and so on, could be taking place or might not. And a lot of this will depend on whether or not, in the end, the Ukraine becomes a colonized state of of Russia, or whether it becomes an independent nation. And meanwhile, and ironically, that's not so simple, because the European Union clearly wants to use Ukraine as a breadbasket, as the Russians
certainly
do, and wants to use it as a place to stage its iron wall, as it were, against Russian expansionism.
That's different than the Iron Curtain.
Different than the Iron Curtain.
Okay. Similar, but different.
Right.
Got it.
Okay. Anyway, we want to hear from you again. Your focus in calling us, this is about Ukraine. You can ask questions. You have comments. Stick to that, please.
All right. Who's up, Steve? Sean, good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Fantastic. Thanks for giving that quick update on Ukraine.
It was a little quick, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and it is important to understand history because, I just say real quick, I mean, if it wasn't for, after almost 800 years of Moorish rule in Spain, the reconquest by Queen Isabel and King Ferdinand, would have changed up the history of the United States, basically.
Yeah, well, it, that yeah. in so, fact had
well,
a
really,
because
1492 and Christopher Columbus and all that good stuff.
Right.
So what I just wanted to point out, I'm sure because of all the facts that I'm sure it's no fault on your own, but I just want to point out that merely Ukraine's strategic location and it just is...
Oh, yeah.
Well, and it's not just the breadbasket what's being left out in modern times and what was quietly done throughout the last 25 years, let's say, were the oil pipelines and gas pipelines put in.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yes.
That's very important.
By the West, which is why the Euro nations want to support that. I mean, it's kind of like six and one half dozen the other. Do you want to join the West or do you want to join the East? Because either way, it's like you said, ultimately what Hitler knew and wanted was the oil.
Right.
And Europe needs that.
Well, he also wanted the breadbasket.
They don't have a supply. And, of course, Russia wants to support it. So, really, those people are always going to be stuck in between. And it's the worst of all evils, really. Either way they go, ultimately what it's all going to be about is fighting over resources.
Yeah, so you're saying much as the past 800 or 900 years have gone, Ukraine is once again squeezed between greater powers to the east and west.
Yeah, and it's like really when you think about it, ultimately that's why they surround, like you said, they surrounded the whole area with military bases. And when you look at its location, the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, that is where they quietly have built these pipelines over the years, knowing to supply through the Bosphorus and all of the West the oil and gas that they absolutely need. And Russia knows that because they want to control it, because, of course, a lot of with China as well. So they are stuck in hell, basically.
Well, yeah, and if you remember, the cutting the gas, reducing the amount of gas flowing, was a powerful weapon used by Russia against the Western countries just last year.
Yep.
And
yep.
And in fact, this is a theme. This energy issue has now become a theme, a meme. I like that of this era.
Yeah, and the fact is that Unocal, I think they sold to a division of Chevron not too many years ago, mm-hmm. but Unocal owned the largest reserves of natural gas in that region, and sold it to Dynergy.
Yeah, Dynergy.
Sold it to Dynergy.
Yeah. Yeah,
and so, I mean, the fact is that unofficially, the West is heavily involved with Putin in controlling that region. Officially, they have to look like they're still enemies in a way.
Yeah,
but really, they're all trying to control it, and of course, it's China. And that's why, unfortunately, again, the massive protests and the fires are just a symbol of the continuing, really, the hell that those people are going to have to put up with, no matter which direction they choose.
Yeah, and largely because of corruption and other forces involved, yep. The Ukrainian people have not benefited from their so-called freedom. And there is, just like there is in the former Soviet Union, a group of oligarchs who essentially live really high on the hog, mm-hmm. while the ordinary men and women of the society suffer. I'm glad you called. I want to give others a chance.
Yeah, that was excellent.
231-8187 is the number to call. But remember, keep your calls to the Ukrainian question.
Yeah, the petropolitics of this all really can't be ignored. I'm really glad the caller brought that up.
Yeah.
In fact, we talked about late last year when about the decision that Yanukovych had before him. Do I throw in with the West? Do I throw in with Russia? One of the factors that led to his decision to go with Russia was the fact that Putin extended to Ukraine a deal to buy natural gas at a drastically discounted rate.
To sell it to them at a drastically
for the Ukrainians to buy it at a discounted rate. Thank you. That's a huge factor in what's going on there, and we can't ignore it.
Oh, absolutely. So now the West has to make a similar offer, but they don't have the natural gas.
Right.
In fact, the natural gas flows from the east to the west.
So what happens next is going to be very, very interesting.
Yeah, and this administration in the United States has shown an enormous degree of restraint, unlike the Bush administration, who like to jump into these things.
I have to say I'm glad about that. I'm really glad we're not jumping precipitously into this situation.
Right.
All right, who's next, Steve? Wendell, good morning.
Hey, Joe and Abe, how are you all doing?
Pretty good. Thank you.
Good. Hey, my points were made by the last caller.
Okay.
On the pipelines, which was what you brought up the last two shows, was Russia probably owns those pipelines cutting through the Ukrainian going into Europe. So,
they're owned by Gazprom.
That was going to be my point, was that the pipelines going through there, cutting through there from Moscow down into Europe are a major factor.
Well, actually, not from Moscow, but basically you're right. Anyway, thanks for the call, man.
Okay, bye.
Yeah. 231-8187. We've been talking about Ukraine. We gave a kind of truncated history of it. The point I was making earlier was that Ukraine is carved out of many, and this is true of much of Europe, of course, carved out of many different peoples with many different traditions, that the Cossacks were a remnant of a previous Middle Ages of horror, mm-hmm. and that they were the shock troops of the Tsars and later shock troops of the Soviets, and that all of this region experienced vast pogroms against the Jewish people as a kind of scapegoat, and that there were a constant heavy-handed controls put on the region once it was in the hands of the Soviet Union. And there was great suffering, and there was collectivization, which really was a horror. And that was part of Stalin's effort to destroy wealthier farmers called kulaks, but also an effort to make sure that the people in the other parts of Russia got adequate food.
Right.
So,
and the thread running through this all is it has long been, for centuries now, a contested region between all sorts of powers as they have risen and fallen.
Absolutely. Lithuania, Poland, the Ottoman Empire. The
Russian Empire.
Austro-Hungary.
Right. Yes, all sorts of people. All right. BT, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, you know, that last couple of calls, and then plus I think I heard someone on one of the shows last week, we were already talking about how, you know, we must be wary because, you know, maybe Putin and the Russians are really the good guys in this one, or there's bad Ukrainians trying to take over.
I don't think there's any good guys in this one.
Or there's bad Ukrainians trying to take over. Well, you know, people could say that kind of stuff, but, you know, I think the thing is, as Joe has mentioned, Ukraine is already independent, but this I think what they're doing now is trying to make sure that they stay independent because Russia... you're trying to bribe them. I think they were going to offer money. Plus, they don't forget that they cut off energy. They did that a few years ago where they just shut down the gas.
Yeah, well, that was largely to put pressure on the Western countries. But yes.
I don't know if they're really doing it again because I think that things happened so quickly in Ukraine last week that even Putin was kind of at a loss of really what to do next without looking too hasty. And, of course, he also had to wait for the Olympics to be over.
Right.
But I think that...
The great propaganda show in the sky.
Yeah, well, you know, it's bad to do something like, you know, bring tanks in when the Olympics are still going on nearby.
Bad form.
But I think a lot of this is... I think no matter what the energy situation is, I think the Ukrainians will be... have more of a say about having energy than if they just remain... At the end of the pipeline from the Russians, who could shut it off any time to punish them.
Yeah, that's
they're
true.
They're nasty people. I mean, Putin is, you know, he's KGB. He just wishes that the USSR could be back together, you know, and they, you know, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, no, I appreciate your call. Thanks a lot, man.
Okay, Joel.
We do know that Putin, before Yanukovych was impeached and before he fled, was encouraging him to crack down on the protesters with the Ukrainian military.
He wanted to have
which
the
is
military
among
commit.
The largest in Europe.
Yes, and essentially the Western powers were warning against that.
Yes.
So it was a very touch-and-go situation, and it was truly a people struggle. But within that people struggle, within those great mobs, were fascists, neo-Nazis, anti-Semites, a lot of reactionaries, as well as the old line of pro-socialist groups. You know, one of the things Stalin did was he took the original communists of the Ukraine mm-hmm. and killed them. He didn't well, want those communists.
No,
he
bad
wanted
commies.
His communists.
Good commies and bad commies.
Right. So, you know, so there's just so much history of horror in all of this.
I've noticed that occasionally we've let that definite article, the, slip in when we talk about Ukraine. We say the Ukraine.
Right.
I was reading here that's a derivation from the original meaning of the word, which is borderland, as you mentioned.
Right.
The borderland.
The borderland.
But since independence in 1990, that's sort of fallen out of fashion. They just want to be called Ukraine.
Right.
Not the Ukraine
right.
anymore.
Right. It's a stylistic endeavor to create a nationalist sentiment.
Indeed. All right. Who's next, Steve? Joel, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Am Joe. I had a question of to what extent you guys know or don't know. You'll see. I was wondering, like, what, you know, originally I was as I was looking and reading and hearing, there was tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, possibly in the streets. And then you know, I watched a debate on Democracy Now about this. Was to what extent do you guys know, or I'm curious if you know anything, the kind of the makeup of it, the demographic of who was in the streets, and then maybe it changed a little to a more militant. I mean, it's funny. I don't even know where to. You know, I know these things are hard.
Well,
to know
yeah,
exactly,
yeah. Let me respond a little bit. First of all, there's no census of it. Obviously, what is known is that it is a nationalist Ukrainian movement. But within that movement are liberals, some of them actually all the way to the left, as survivors of the tradition of honest communism. Also, there are large numbers, though I would say it's a small minority in a larger context, of true fascists, neo-Nazis, kind of nostalgic for the old Nazi system, as well as newer neo-Nazis, many of whom are very very anti-Semitic, and that in turn plays into the sense of deep dislike of the West, particularly the United States, which is seen as an ally, a significant ally of Israel. So you have this anti-Semite, anti-U.S. sentiment among many of these people. And you've got to understand that thuggery is part of that. Much of the most violent acts committed by the mobs have been said to be part of that right-wing neo-Nazi movement.
And I don't think we can discount a legitimate desire amongst many, if not most, Ukrainians for true independence and self-determination.
I think that's the majority of sentiment.
Yes.
Well, that helps a lot. Yeah, I know it's hard to know stuff. I was thinking about Venezuela as well, and some things I've been hearing is that, it's a kind of slightly higher middle class people in the streets more, but that's changing. People are just generally have unrest, and I know these things all look differently. I feel like it's possible that a proto, like extreme right in the U.S. could they have anger and they have some protest. Anyway, I didn't know where it was at, and you guys helped a lot, so thank you.
Okay,
yeah, you're welcome.
We're not getting into Venezuela today.
No, we're not.
We don't have time.
Have a good day.
Yeah,
thanks,
you too. Thank you for the call.
Yeah.
All right, who's next, Eve? Charlotte. Good morning. Are you there?
Hello. Yeah.
Yes. Hello.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about just the broader picture, because what I see is a reestablishment of the Cold War to some extent, and it's not just because of the Russians. There's been a lot of action on the West that has been threatening to Russia and trying to limit and take away part, for example, of Ukraine, what used to be the original Russia. And I'm just concerned about us, the U.S. and the West, trying to reestablish this kind of development. And so I think that people should look very closely at the bigger picture and at what everybody's doing. I'm not at all a fan of Putin and of authoritarian regimes, but I'll just give you one example that I just heard. You mentioned that embedded within the Euro, there actually was an agreement that at the last minute Yanukovych did not sign to have both economic and military relationships with the European Union and with the West. And the Russians actually have a military base in Ukraine that is their navy in the Black Sea,
right,
in Sebastopol. And if it's just about economics, they didn't have to have this military element to it, but that was a choice of the West to have that in it, and which creates a threat both on the borders of Russia and to a military base. Now,
we're out of time. I'm really sorry.
That's too bad, because I would really like to address that. I don't think we're seeing the reestablishment of the Cold War, but we don't have time.
Well, I think she's making some important points. I'm sorry that we've run out of time.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody. Thanks for bearing with us in our sort of disjointed history of Ukraine. And I really appreciate your calls. And hopefully that has led to a deeper level of understanding out there.
I hope so.
All right.
Community Radio is proud to host an open house to say goodbye to our interim station manager, Victoria Stoppiello, and to welcome our new co-managers, Monica Beamer and Mike Crenshaw.
Please come to KBOO on March 1st between noon and 4 p.m. for greeting and meeting, snacks, tours, and a general celebration of the start of our 46th year broadcasting.
KBOO is located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, a half block south of Burnside in Portland.
Again, this March 1st, noon to 4, here at your community radio station, KBOO. More information can be found at kboo.fm.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com. Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First, on Alternative Radio, reporter and author Sonia Nazario speaks on the courage of immigrants. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, anti-war resistor Colonel Ann Wright reports back on the geopolitical struggle against U.S. power in the Koreas. And host Dennis Bernstein speaks with Dr. Victor Rios, author of Punished, Policing the Lives of Black and Latino Boys. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host Demay Roberts features the 7th Annual Portland, Oregon Women's Film Festival at the Hollywood Theater. We'll also hear a feature piece on Defunct Theater's production of Let a Hundred Flowers Bloom. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake speaks with Ryan Reuter and Rhea Reuter Sleeman about the work of their father, the late American painter Leonard Reuter. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. You keep this station on the air. If you missed it, you can still contribute by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now here's Alternative Radio.
I was stunned by the gritty determination of people to make it through Mexico, including these children. I watched a boy, he lost his leg 3 weeks before to that freight train, and I watched him get back up on that train in his desire to reach the United States. And Enrique makes 8 attempts, and he travels 122 days and 12,000 miles in what I think can only be described as a modern day odyssey these children make.
That's Sonia Nazario, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Sonia Nazario on the courage of immigrants. Emma Lazarus, in her poem inscribed on the Statue of Liberty, wrote, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." Bedros, my father, might have seen those words in 1914 when he landed at Ellis Island. And Araxi, my mother too, 7 years later when she arrived. My parents were highly motivated to leave Armenia, their ancestral homeland in eastern Turkey. Genocide does a lot to focus the mind on survival. For them and millions of others, America was a safe haven. Today, violence, economic terror, and hunger drive many to come to these shores. Immigration reform is talked about, but little happens. NAFTA and rapacious capitalist policies have pauperized many people in Mexico and Central America. The trek north is dangerous. Women and children are particularly vulnerable. The journey requires tenacity and courage. To talk about these issues is Sonia Nazario. She's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the Polk Award. She's reported for the Wall Street Journal and the Los Angeles Times. Her book, Enrique's Journey, was a bestseller. She spoke in Denver at the America's Latino Festival. And now, Sonia Nazario.
I became an expert in what's called fly on the wall reporting. So what I do is I drop myself in the middle of the action and I watch it unfold. My goal is always to grab you all by the throat and take you on a ride and hopefully educate you about one of these big social issues in this country. I think that that way of telling stories, it brings an immediacy and a power that you just can't get any other way, and it helps me take people inside worlds that they might not otherwise see. So, you know, doing this took me to some hard places. I was in riot zones and in very difficult neighborhoods in this country, and I hung out in crack sheds writing about 1 in 5 kids in this country who grows up with a parent addicted to drugs or alcohol, and sometimes it would produce good things. I wrote about hunger among school children in California, how increasingly school districts were being dominated by religious right members who thought, heck, if a parent can't feed their kid breakfast, what are they good for? So these districts were not availing themselves of federally funded breakfast programs. And I showed in these districts how these kids, you know, they were hungry by 10 a.m. They were outside the nurse's station in a line with headaches and stomach aches, and how they would drop in the playground at recess, and how obviously they couldn't learn because they couldn't think. And after writing about this in the LA Times, California went overnight from a third of schools feeding their kids breakfast to two-thirds of them doing that. So I knew I was lacking in a whole lot of qualities. But ganas, determination, was not one of them. I thought I had that down in abundance. But then one day, I had a conversation with Carmen, a woman who would come clean my house a couple of times a month. She was normally this really chatty, happy woman. But that morning in my kitchen, I asked